Welcome to On Contact. Today we discuss the assault against girls and women with feminists Mary Lou Singleton and Maya Dillard Smith.
How do you create accommodations for trans people at the same time that we don't overly or unnecessarily infringe on the rights of others, like women or children or parents?
I think children should be able to do whatever they want. Like, how, what does it mean to live as a boy or live as a girl other than sexism?
On Contact with Chris Hedges. Patriarchy across the globe plagues humankind. Female fetuses are aborted from the womb because they are considered less valuable than males. Girls are sometimes smothered in infancy. Women and girls are sold to men as rape and breeding slaves. They endure genital mutilation. They are trafficked and forced into prostitution. They suffer court-ordered cesarean operations. They are in many places denied abortions and access to birth control. They are considered in some countries as the property of male guardians. And they are often denied education and economic equality. Biological sex remains a potent form of oppression, driven by geo-social, political, religious, and historical forces that serve patriarchy. All girls and women feel this oppression in varying degrees. How, in an age of gender identity, where those born with male bodies self-identify as women, can those born as girls define their unique oppression based on their experience? As laws in Europe, Canada, and the U.S. are being rewritten to broaden our definition of what it means to be female, what are the implications for the safety and privacy of girls and women? RT correspondent Anya Parampel looks at the economic realities for women and the violence, including rape, that plague girls and women.
Behind the glittery facade of American progress embodied in liberal feminist icons, the equity gap in the United States has much shrinking to do. For example, as of 2015, even in more progressive states like California, the pay gap between men and women was as high as 10% to 15%. In Louisiana and Wyoming, however, that number is as high as 35%. That year, women earned on average 21% less than their male counterparts. Perhaps unsurprisingly, women of color are most impacted by the wage gap, with Hispanic women earning on average 55% of the wages white men earn. Women who have children are on average paid 3% less than women with no children. Yet, bizarrely, men with children see their wages increase by about 15%. But women don't only face economic disadvantages. They also face shocking rates of violence. The National Sexual Violence Resource Center reports a shockingly high number of American men, 1 in 71, are raped in their lifetime. But for women, that rate is a whopping 1 in 5. An even more horrifically high number of women experience domestic abuse in the United States, as 1 in 3 women report experiencing some sort of physical violence from a romantic partner in their lifetime. That's 1/3 of American women. So as the U.S. employs military interventionism abroad in the name of spreading human rights, perhaps we should have a conversation about how we can improve things at home first.
Thank you, Anya. I'm joined today by Mary Lou Singleton and Maya Dillard Smith. Maya is the former head of Georgia's ACLU chapter. She was pushed out over her questioning of President Obama's directive for schools to let transgender students use the bathroom of their choice. She is a legal scholar, civil rights activist, political strategist, social entrepreneur, and news commentator whose work explores the intersectionality of law, policy, and economics on issues of race, class, and gender. Mary Lou is a midwife, nurse, practitioner, and lifelong women's liberation activist from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
So, Mary Lou, let's begin with you. Just basically explain to us what patriarchy is, how it works, especially in the U.S., and how patriarchy is used by both the right and the left.
Sure. So patriarchy is a millennia-old system of male supremacy by which male-bodied people are exploiting female-bodied people for reproductive, sexual, emotional, domestic labor. When power and property are held by men and passed to the heirs of men, men need to police and control women's bodies to know who their heirs are. And so the system that arose millennia ago out of private property now is global in scope, where women don't have control over our own reproduction and are dependent on men in terms of having and raising our children. how that plays out in the United States, where people think patriarchy doesn't exist anymore, are things like what gets called the wage gap, where women are unable to make enough money to support themselves and their children, and women with children, whether it's through having a boyfriend, engaging in prostitution, or through marriage, are dependent on creating a transactional sex relationship with a man in order to have financial stability for their children. That's one example. Within that, the sex industry is an example of patriarchy, where male-bodied people feel like they have a right to purchase the bodies of female-bodied
and
people.
And we should just interject that this is an utterly pornified culture.
Yes, absolutely. So women are groomed from birth through a system of female socialization, which also could be called gender, to participate in this, that we know that we'll be rewarded to a certain degree if we participate.
But hence, slut walks.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll be punished if we go up against it.
Talk, just before I talk to Maya, a little bit about how patriarchy works among the left.
Patriarchy works among the on the left in the form of really glorifying sex work as legitimate work at this point. There's this push to, in our country, I mean, there are other countries that have the Nordic model, which is a model that's actually liberatory to women, where it's legal to sell sex, illegal to buy it. Here in the American, what gets called the left, there's a push to promote prostitution as a legitimate work for young women. I have a 23-year-old daughter who talks about how most of her female friends have considered or have worked somewhat in the sex industry to pay off their student loans. Egg selling industry, like women are encouraged in patriarchal capitalism to commodify their bodies and sell their bodies.
So Maya, as a lawyer, what does it mean to change the law so that men can self-identify as women?
Well, there are two primary vehicles that are being explored right now. One is through Title IX. Title IX is a 1973 legislative act that essentially required all schools that receive federal funding, it prohibited them from discriminating against folks on the basis of sex. And so one of the ways in which the law is attempting to be converted is under the Obama guidelines that were issued last year. It basically reads into the prohibition against sex discrimination a opportunity to read that as gender identity, so as to say someone who self-identifies as male or female should be extended the same protections as someone born a woman. And what that means practically is that in the context of schools, in sports, housing, bathroom and locker room facilities, it would mean that individuals would have access to those facilities. However, the 1975, there was a case that Ruth Bader Ginsburg argued where Justice Kennedy essentially said that sex, like race, is an immutable characteristic. And what it means to be a mutable characteristic is that, by no fault of your own, just by an accident of DNA, you are either born with melanin in your skin, like me as a black woman, or to be female with or male with your sex organs, right? And that there is nothing that can mutate that. Well, what we know is that with the advancement of science and technology, those things are expanding. So that's one vehicle, is through Title IX. Another vehicle is through equal protection. And equal protection is the basis on which this notion of immutable characteristics first arose, and it arose to protect African Americans against race discrimination. One of the interesting intersections of the current pathway on transgender rights is that it particularly implicates issues of race. As you all may have been seeing in the news media, there's now a term called trans black or trans race that's being highlighted, particularly by the woman, the white woman, Rachel Dolezal from the Northwest, who passed as a black woman leader in the NAACP and now identifies herself as trans black or transracial. And so the implications in the law will serve to have some consequences both on the gender continuum, with the greatest consequence to the advancement of rights for women, but also have deep consequences on the advancement of people of color.
And what's your position on that?
Well, my concern is, how do we explore these rights for transgender folks in a way that does not undermine the rights of women or people of color? Because there have to be accommodations, I do believe, but how do we do that in the most in the way that does the least harm to infringe on the rights of
but
others?
But ultimately, is sex mutable? Is race mutable? Are these mutable categories?
I tend to think that race is an immutable characteristic, as is gender. Now, that we have technological advancement that mutate those things does not convert the biological realities.
Which we could say can even be, they can change skin tone, I mean, right?
We can change hair color, eye right. color, any right. of those things, right?
right?
But there isn't protection that says you can't be discriminated on the basis of having blue eyes versus brown eyes, right? I think what we ought to be very cautious about, however, is how do we distinguish between gender and gender identity from the legal basis of sex under the law, which means how you were born, how you came into the world. And some folks will argue, well, that's just, you know, an old way of thinking and a bigoted way of thinking to discriminate against trans folks. Well, I tend to see things differently, and let me give you a couple of examples. One example that regularly comes up, particularly since so much of this debate is around bathrooms, okay? And it's really unfortunate that we're starting an entire national narrative around bathrooms, because there's so many other issues that are at play. But let's just start with bathrooms. There are a lot of folks who say, well, by not allowing trans people to go into the bathroom of their gender identity is creating separate but equal facilities, okay? And they equate that to the separate but equal facilities that existed before the civil rights movement, where we segregated bathrooms on the basis of race. To that I say, when bathrooms were discriminated, were separated on the basis of race, it was done so purely for discriminatory purposes, okay?
We're gonna come back to that
okay.
in a sec. When we return, we'll hear more from Mary Lou Singleton and Maya Dillard Smith. On Contact with Chris Hedges. Welcome back to On Contact. We continue our conversation with Mary Lou Singleton, who is a midwife, nurse practitioner, and lifelong women's liberation activist, and Maya Dillard Smith, a legal scholar and civil rights activist. So we were speaking about bathrooms.
Sure. So just to wrap up the point, so the difference in terms of the single-sex bathrooms, which are bathrooms for men and bathrooms for women, is that the 1975 implementation of Title IX specifically permitted these things on the basis of protecting the privacy and safety rights of women. But what it said is that in providing them, you had to provide equal accommodations, right? And so in that instance, there was a legitimate justification that was not discriminatory and didn't even contemplate transgender people at the time, right? And so a lot of people say, so what's the solution to bathrooms now? Well, there seems to me to be two possible solutions. One is to create single stall bathrooms that anyone can use and that they're large enough to accommodate the requirements for ADA and disabled people and families, and anybody can go in and have privacy and safety. Another option is to create gender-specific bathrooms, which we already have, and then create an additional bathroom much like I just described, that anyone could go into that would be large enough to accommodate ADA and families and other folks. But to the question of the distinction between sex and gender, historically, sex and gender were almost synonymous, and it meant that sex is what you were born with biologically. And so as a woman or female, as distinguished from being a woman, I have certain anatomy that men typically don't have. But as a woman and the notion of gender or gender identity, it really is about how we present in the world, what are the issues that we confront as women in the world around mothering, around medical and reproductive issues like menstruation and different things like that men don't deal with, and vice versa. And so in that way, gender is really about the lived experience of the female body in our society and in a male patriarchy society.
Mary Lou, you now have this debate about what it means to be a female. What are the implications for the safety and the privacy rights of women and girls of this?
So women have sex-based protections under the law, and actually under the UN there are certain sex-based protections that female prisoners deserve to be housed separately from men. If a prison is containing both sexes, the women need to be as far as possible from the men. That's international law. That's also U.S. law. Now we're having a situation where any male criminal can self-declare as a woman. Even if this is a serial rapist, these men are being transferred to women's prisons. There are lawsuits in Texas and California where women are feeling unsafe with these male-bodied people, these violent male-bodied people in prison. The current narrative is very unsympathetic to those women, but I understand why they're afraid. Our crime statistics are changing. Men who identify as women who rape women with their penises are being, those crimes, when they are being recorded as having been committed by women. Those are examples. If a woman wants to seek shelter at a women's shelter, there may be male-bodied people. There have been attacks in those shelters by male-bodied people on female-bodied people.
To what extent does identity politics become an extension of a capitalist consumer society which is intent on destroying any class or gender consciousness?
Well, yes, capitalism thrives on promoting extreme individualism and this idea that we are all separate, unique individuals. We're at a point in late-stage capitalism where identity is for sale, and people take on consumer identities. And I believe that this particular identity is being marketed to our young people who are at an age where they experience a lot of questioning naturally about their identity. It's always been acknowledged that children and teenagers and young adults question who they are and what they want to be.
Well, let's get into that, because there is an entire industry, a $1 billion industry, about gender reassignment surgery, drugs, hormones that block puberty, and secondary sex characteristics for children.
Yes.
And this is something you come out of the medical field. We don't try children anymore as adults because of this great case brought before the Supreme Court by Brian Stevenson. We know that neurologically, and yet children are ingesting all sorts of drugs. Talk a little bit about what that process, what's been happening, that landscape.
Pediatric medical gender transition is being pushed extensively in the medical field. Every conference brochure I get has something about transgenderism. Excuse me, and the pediatric conferences definitely are pushing this. It's a huge money-making experiment on our children, where children as young as toddlers are being diagnosed as in the wrong body and taken to these gender clinics where they are first socially transitioned to live as a boy or live as a girl, live as the opposite sex, which I find that problematic too. I think children should be able to do whatever they want. Like, what does it mean to live as a boy or live as a girl other than sexism? And then after social transitioning, when those children get close to puberty, they are placed on very strong drugs that suppress puberty. They're called puberty blockers. Those drugs have many long-term dangerous side effects that we already know about from children with other true disorders who've been put on them in the past. And then once they hit young adolescence, and their peers are starting to go through puberty, and they still have a child's body, that the pressure is to then give them cross-sex hormones.
And they're on this stuff for life.
Yes. If you give a child puberty blockers and then cross-sex hormones before a natural puberty, that child will never develop normally as the sex they are. They will be permanently sterile, and they will be permanently dependent on synthetic hormones because their ovaries or testes never developed and cannot make their own hormones.
Can I interject?
Yeah, sure.
You know, one of the interesting things is I had the opportunity to work in the Ninth Circuit on the gay conversion therapy ban. And what's interesting to me is a lot of the arguments against gay conversion therapy are very much raised with this new medical approach of interrupting children's natural development. And so it's really curious to me that the pendulum has swung on the one hand, because as a society and as legal courts, it has been decided that gay conversion therapy is not okay, which basically was to block someone from being gay. But it seems to me that this is the opposite side of the same coin, where we are also using medical interventions to promote a different way of living than, you know, what someone naturally might otherwise be or do biologically.
You've both been attacked, like many outspoken feminists on this issue, and we won't go into the details, but some of these attacks have been very vicious. What is your position, I mean, just straightforward, on being trans?
So I'll start. My life's work is about defending the rights of all people. And in so doing, I am called to balance the rights of all people. And what I am exploring in raising the questions that I have been raising and exploring these issues is, how do you create accommodations for trans people at the same time that we don't overly or unnecessarily infringe on the rights of others, like women or children or parents? And for me, it's a delicate balance. But to achieve that balance, we must engage in the healthy discourse and agree to disagree to come up with the best public policy possible. And to me, that was both a failure of the Obama guidance letter from last year, which directed schools to implement, you know, allowing students to decide the bathroom and locker rooms of their choice, without going through the requisite notice and comment period that is required any time we move federal rule changes. In the same way that in North Carolina, a Republican-led legislature there passed its law to limit bathrooms to use by those of biological sex in a day with no public comment. So I have an issue on both sides. If we're circumventing the public process that is paramount to due process and our democracy. And so that's an issue on the right and the left that I'm deeply concerned about, and why I am so vocal about this issue.
But let me just get you to answer that quickly, and then we'll close. We have a minute left. I want you to address to what extent the trans narrative reinforces female stereotypes created by patriarchy.
I'm fully supportive of the rights of transgender people to be free of discrimination. And like Maya, I think we need a national conversation on where those rights end and where women's rights begin. From what I can see, the trans narrative very much reinforces patriarchy, because in our culture, gender is a synonym for sexism. It's the behavioral caste system that says how men behave, how women behave. It has no basis in material reality. It's completely based on sexual stereotypes. And when you hear I've never heard a trans narrative that does not rely on sexist stereotypes to explain how someone knew they were actually born in the wrong body.
Right.
I'd like to return to the old feminist war cry of start a revolution, stop hating your body.
Wonderful. Thank you. That was Mary Lou Singleton and Maya Dillard Smith. The rights of girls and women were once guaranteed under Title IX, but new laws are erasing these rights by blurring the lines of what it means to be female. While many trans people face discrimination and have been victims of hate crimes, discrimination is not the same as oppression. And transgender people are attacked precisely because they do not conform to rigid gender stereotypes, stereotypes that need to be eradicated. Girls and women are forced into a category at birth. They have no choice, and they should be allowed to define how they band together to fight misogyny and patriarchy and build a collective consciousness. The erasure of this sisterhood is a gift to patriarchy, which in an age of neoliberalism seeks to turn everyone, especially the most vulnerable, into commodities. We must acknowledge the reality of the social humiliation directed against girls and women, especially since in times of social disintegration, they are the ones, along with children and the elderly, who usually suffer most. Thank you for watching. You can find us on rt.com/oncontact. Until next week.